Hey neighbors, welcome to Motherhood in Hollywood podcast episode 58. And this is a doozy, you guys. Lots of stuff in here for actors, some really fun, silly stories maybe about a blogging conference I went to. And and speaking of the blogging conference, I got to meet Mariah from Up4 Probiotics. Yay! For those of you who don't know, Up4 sponsors my podcast, my little podcast that could. And I'm so grateful to have their support and them as sponsors. And I want to say hello to everybody back in the home office of Up4 Probiotics in Wausau, Wisconsin. I hope I'm saying that right. That's where they have a state-of-the-art manufacturing facility, and they manufacture Up4 Probiotics. They've been creating Up4 Probiotic supplements since 1979 with shelf-stable formulas. There's no need to refrigerate them. They come in chewables, powders, capsules, and they make them for everybody in your family, from infants to senior citizens. The cool thing about Up4, you guys, is they're also available in your Target store. How convenient is that? So while you're out shopping at Target, you can also pick up your Up4. But if you'd like to shop online, go to motherhoodinhollywood.com, click on the Up4 Probiotics image. That will take you right to their website where you can learn more about these wonderful probiotic supplements and what they can do for you. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later in the show. So, hey, Mariah. Hey, everybody in the Up4 Probiotics office. So great to meet you. So great to have you on board with Motherhood in Hollywood. And yeah. All right. What was I saying? I'm losing my voice. I've been talking a lot this past weekend. All right. Let's get on with the show.
Come on, Mama.
Grab your popcorn and goobers. It's time for Motherhood in Hollywood with your host, Heather Brooker. This is a crude prude's perspective on being a full-time mom in showbiz. She's not a perfect mom, but she can play one on TV. Hold on to your butts. Here's Heather.
Hello, friends. So glad you're here. We have a big show today. I want to get right to it as quickly as possible, which means I may only talk for 20 minutes. My mommy monologue before I actually get to the interview. No, it won't be that long. But I'm so excited to share this interview with you because I interviewed big time casting director Risa Brayman Garcia. And she's also a director, producer, and an acting teacher here in Los Angeles at the BGB Acting Studio. You guys might, I know you will recognize some of the shows that she's cast and worked on. More recently, she just finished casting Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life. What? You guys, so exciting. Masters of Sex. She worked on CSI New York. And that's some of her television programs. But you guys, she has cast some of the most legendary films of our lifetimes, of my lifetime. Natural Born Killers, Speed, The Joy Luck Club, True Romance. I mean, get out of here. And the very first movie that she cast was a movie that's very near and dear to my heart, Desperately Seeking Susan, starring Madonna. There's something about that movie that totally defined my generation as the 80s baby. Like, everybody wanted to dress like Madonna and be her, and she was so cool. And, you know, things have kind of taken a little detour since then. But, I mean, she's still Madonna. It's cool. Anyway, so I talked to Risa about what it takes today for actors to make it, to break through, versus how it was 20 years ago. She shares her story and her love of teaching at this moment in her life, and how she's been very fluid in her career and open to casting these huge movies, but also she has a true passion for directing theater, which I didn't know. She also directed the movie 200 Cigarettes, which has a massive cast, and she cast the movie JFK. And anyway, I could just go on and on, but I'm going to let her tell you about her story and how it evolved from being a theater director into casting director into director and writer and now teacher and producer. So it's truly a fascinating story, and you guys will definitely want to listen up. Listen up, kids. Okay, before we get into that, really quickly, I want to tell you guys, I went to this blogging conference here in Los Angeles this weekend. If you haven't heard of it, it's called Blog Her. And it's sort of like I was trying to describe it to Chris, and I was like, it's like a Comic-Con, but for female bloggers. And he goes, that sounds awful. And I was like, you're such a jerk. But basically, yeah, that's what it is. There's like keynote speakers and panels that you go and see and listen to other female writers. And there are some guys there too. And it's mostly women. So they're all sharing their experiences. They're talking about social media. There's like an expo set up where you can meet vendors and whatnot. And what was really cool about it was that I got to meet a lot of great companies, but also I got to reconnect with some mommy friends that I've met through Motherhood in Hollywood, and also meet ones that I have just sort of met online. So I get... like I'm a very personable and outgoing person. For those of you who know me, my friends who know me a long time know that I'm just sort of loud and, you know, bubbly and whatever, snarky as all hell. But I still get these moments where I'm really awkward around people who I really like or I want to be friends with, and I don't really know, like, especially if it's a fellow mom friend. I wrote something about this for the Huffington Post about like mom dating and you know, moms meeting each other and like trying to figure out if you're going to be friends. Anyway, so I had this moment where I suddenly get like insecure and awkward, and I start saying stupid things. I don't know if this ever happens to you, but there's this one mom who, she's actually been on my podcast. It was Morgan Shanahan. She works for BuzzFeed. And I just think that she's really cool chick. And I think that she's smart and like funny. And I was like, oh man, you know, I want to be friends with her. And, you know, spoiler alert here, I'm not friends with everybody that comes on my show. I mean, I'm friendly with them, but we don't go on to be like best friends. Anyway, side note. But anyway, so I remember seeing her. I saw her there at the conference, and I was like, oh my gosh, Morgan, hi. You know, it's Heather from Motherhood in Hollywood. And she's like, oh, hi. She was super nice, very pleasant. And then I don't know why, but I suddenly got very nervous, and I started saying stupid, like creepy stuff like, oh, I'm obsessed with you. What the hell? Who says that? And then she was like, oh, okay, yeah. And then, like, I just sort of, like, wandered off with this, like, creepy look in my eye, like, having just told someone I have met one time, essentially, and told them I'm obsessed with them. All I can think of, like, is what's wrong with me. I have this, like, word vomit when I get nervous, and I just start saying random stuff. So anyway, then everywhere I went, she was there, and it totally looked like I was stalking her. I mean, 100%. I'm sure she was like, oh my God, this girl is insane. So I would just like to put it out there that I hope I'm not the only one who gets nervous and awkward in situations like that. But it was definitely a moment where I was like, pull it together, Brooker. Anyway, I do like you a lot, Morgan. I do like Morgan a lot. I'm not obsessed with you. Please don't think I'm a creeper. Anyway, so the conference was a lot of fun, and I had a great time. And I'll talk more about that coming up in the next few episodes. Maybe share what I learned. Maybe not. Maybe I'll keep it all to myself. What do you think about that? All right, so I want to quickly say hello to a few followers over on Twitter, like we do, the Twitter moments. Maybe I should call this part of the show something. Well, just the shout outs. I don't know. I'll think of something else. I want to say hello to Renita Casting. Thank you so much for finding me and following me at MIH Podcast. I want to say hello to Beverly Hills Mom, Alexandra 90210. That's a good screen name for you. It's a good handle. Femme Frugality. That's a good one. And also Brooke Poston, I hope I'm saying that right, this modest mom. Thank you guys for taking the time to find me at Motherhood in Hollywood over on Twitter at MIH Podcast. And for the rest of you guys, you can also find me on Instagram at Motherhood in Hollywood and Facebook as well. I do a lot of fun posting and silliness, and I love to interact with everybody. So thank you to everyone who's taken the time to find me and give me shout outs. Give me a little love back. If you haven't done it yet, please take a minute, share the show with friends. If you've got a friend who you think might enjoy hearing about acting, directing, producing, Hollywood-related parenting topics and that sort of thing, send me their way. Send them my way. Whatever's easiest. And then take a minute to subscribe to the show. I really appreciate it. It does make a difference on my little iTunes ranking. So appreciate you. Okay, so I want to get to the interview with Risa, and really listen to what she's saying about, you know, especially towards the end of the interview. I asked her, when as an actor do we know if we should quit? If we should maybe pack up and move back home, or maybe this isn't working. And what she said, I found to be very profound and very enlightening for me. She's a very wise lady. She's been in this business a long time. She knows what she's talking about and was very generous with her time with me and her thoughts. And I hope you guys really glean as much from it as I did. If you did, please take a minute to share the show with somebody who you think also might benefit from it as well. So here is my interview with casting director and acting teacher Risa Braman Garcia.
When I would go to New York with my family, one thing I would do is get my cousins and my mother to take me to see Broadway shows. We'd stayed in Queens at my grandparents, and we would go into the city. And my grandfather was a jeweler, and I would help him at work and count rings and play with gold dust and whatnot. And then go to
that
see.
That sounds fun.
It was fun. Weird, but fun. And I went to see, would see Broadway shows. I didn't know that those days about off-Broadway or off-off-Broadway. But I went to see Broadway shows and went and fell in love with theater in that way.
What did you see that kind of stuck with you?
I saw For Colored Girls. Mm-hmm. I remember that blew my mind. I remember seeing Pippin. Also, that was amazing. I remember seeing some stuff, some Shakespeare in the Park stuff. When I was much younger, I don't remember exactly what it was that I saw, but I did, through those shows, start to realize, oh, this is an amazing opportunity to do this is what I want to do. This is where I'm headed. And it wasn't so much about Broadway, but doing...
directing theater.
Yeah.
Any kind of theater, large scale theater, musical theater?
Well, I started off with the musical idea.
You gravitated towards that?
Well, I think it was also, you know, as you come up through camp and through school, you know, that's what people did. They did musicals, where I was growing up. And so I was also a dancer, and I was interested in dance and theater as well. And it wasn't until I got to college that I realized that there were some alternative things you could do. But at the time, I was interested in pretty traditional things. And then when the person who was supposed to direct, the teacher who was supposed to direct the high school play left, they decided to not have a high school musical the year I became a senior. And I thought, no, this is not okay.
Yeah.
Because I was going to be the assistant.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I was when in camp when I was younger. And so I went to the principal, and long story short, I ended up directing the high school musical with South Pacific. I chose it myself.
Oh, wow.
And I remember that was a definitive moment for me, because I remember it was very ambitious for me to do this.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely. I can't imagine.
Turning, my whole life around. But it was everything that theater is and the whole what I've made of this business, which is a really big part of how we created this studio and what theater and an artistic community has meant to me, I created right there in that high school group. Mm-hmm. And we did this play and we all came together, and it was really good. And I remember standing at the back of the auditorium during their first night of Bows and realizing, oh, this works. This is it.
I could do this for a living. I could do this forever.
I could do this forever. Yeah. I have to do this forever. This is the, and it was a really powerful moment for me. And I felt like I belonged somewhere, and that I found my purpose or my, mm-hmm. It was always that. And that's always been my touchstone all these many, many years later.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And for an actor, from an actor's perspective, it's hard for me to ever imagine that somebody wouldn't want to be an actor.
Really?
I'm always like, oh, you don't want to be in the center spotlight and the stage and have your moment and all of that stuff. So actors can be very, you know, sort of like tunnel focused, tunnel vision kind of thing.
Which
sometimes.
I think is something, I mean, I say that to actors all the time here at the studio, as does Steve, is that especially these days and in this industry, the way it's evolved, you have to find a way to do more than that. You've got to create another career.
That.
You've got to have, I was just watching a video this morning that Gracie Mercedes and Clayton Ferris, who are actors here, did this really funny takeoff on the the car stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The
driving in cars or
no the singing in cars
the karaoke, the karaoke carpool karaoke yeah
they did their version of it with Hamilton and
oh, that's fun
and it was fun and it was just like they got to act today, they created this thing and they put it up whether they did it today or yesterday, and it's really fun and not that big a deal. So basically they just figured out very minimalistic technology that they could use, just
set it up in your car,
look better than it does on
James Corden.
James, yeah. Mm-hmm. Their version of it anyway. And it was edited together like they did flash edit and editing and you know, like quick dissolves or uh-huh. cuts. So it wasn't continuous, but it was really fun and clever. And it just speaks to, and we just did a bunch of actor video interviews about this with some of our actors who are creating their own work and changing their careers and evolving their careers and mm-hmm. growing their artistry and taking command of what they're doing, even like you're doing with your show. You've got to, as an actor, do more than just sit around and wait for someone to give you permission to act.
Especially now, like, because you have you noticed, you can't. Is that one of the biggest changes you would say has happened over the past 30 some odd years? Because sometimes I feel like had I been out here in LA as a young gal acting in the 80s or 90s, like maybe I would have had a better shot. But now it just seems like it's such a saturated industry. Everybody is doing their own content. Yeah. Everybody's trying to do the look at me to get eyeballs, social media followers, a fan base, that sort of thing, that it's hard for anybody to break through.
It's always been hard.
Yeah.
And it's always been easy in that, you know, you do the work you love and you find a way to do it, whether you're doing it now, you can make that video and put it out on Facebook and people will see it and you never know what will come of it. Mm-hmm. But there were other ways before, and that's where the theater has always been for me also, is a place, a resource, a touchstone where actors can go and be a part of something and be in a reading and have people see it. And I think that we're all more isolated now, but that so we see things online more than we used to in person, but mm-hmm. I think it's always been a challenge to be seen, and also, and the reverse of that is when you're doing work and putting it out there, people will find you and see you. And I still encourage wherever town you're in to be a part of some kind of theater community, also that where you can be a part of work that's being created, whether you're creating it or whether you're workshopping it.
Right.
It's just hugely powerful. You never know what's going to come of it.
Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, there were fewer actors maybe 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But there were also fewer jobs.
Yeah, that's true. With online streaming places now, like your Netflix, your Amazon, Hulu, so all of that. There's so much more content also being created. I want to talk to you about, now I know you had kind of mentioned that casting became like the side job.
It was always a means to an end.
A means to an end.
Yeah. And this doesn't knock casting directors who love it for its own sake and are mm-hmm. fully invested in it. I admire their passion and compassion and commitment to it. It's just not my priority or my main thing. I mean, I like it. Mm-hmm. I do. I'm good at it. Mm-hmm. But it's not the thing that just gets me excited the way that
I look at your resume and some of the movies you worked on, and I'm like, oh, this is amazing. Yeah. You've worked on some of the most iconic films and cast some of the most iconic films over the last three decades and television shows. Roseanne was a huge fan of Roseanne.
Yeah.
And did you work on that throughout its entire
career? No, just the beginning.
Just the beginning?
Yeah.
And
because it was here and I was in New York still.
Oh, and you cast out of New York?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, even before there was the internet.
That's unbelievable. Crazy. How did you do that? Did you just get lots of headshots? And
No.
Did people audition for you over the phone?
No. Oh. I mean, we auditioned people in... We came to L.A. a couple of times, but the main people in the show, John and Lori, who were with Roseanne, were in New York, I think, or New York based, and mm-hmm. we happened to know them, and they were considering being here. Maybe John, I think he was still in New York. So that was, and one of Lisi was in Chicago. People would put themselves on videotape, VHS,
yeah,
and then put the VHS in a FedEx envelope and ship it to you.
Oh, I can't imagine. imagine.
And it was perfectly fine. It was very advanced at the time.
I was going to say, that's so high tech for back in the like 80s.
But that's what we did. And we would like have two or three decks of video of VHS recorders, and we would have our assistants sit there and like literally
cue them up
and then
and make
copies too. If we had to select takes or select actors and send them to producers, we would do the same thing. But the way we would do it was we would, you know, play a take and then copy it onto the next VHS, and then we would create, you know, what we do now online,
like
and then we would take that and put it in a FedEx envelope and run to the FedEx and get it to LA or
wherever
we were headed.
Things are a lot easier now, right?
They're easier, but the volume has grown so much that, you know, you'd see actors, but you would send your 10 actors in as opposed to 100, or, you know, because now people expect you to see hundreds and hundreds of people.
Yeah, why is that? So, what is that about?
Because they can.
I go to auditions sometimes and it's for like maybe a small like 2 or 3 line part, but there may be like 30 or 40 people reading. Is that because you feel like as a casting director, like, oh, I got so many submissions, I have to bring this
many in? Well, we see people here because we want to, and we want to be able to give so many more actors opportunities, but there is an expectation of volume. There was one project I did and one network that said literally we just need more volume, and
like in terms of what you're giving them. I see.
And so we just were bringing people in just to meet certain numbers. Okay, here are another 50 people.
Whether or not you agreed with that necessarily,
it was just wanting more.
Wow.
And there's also a sense of, well, there's always somebody else. There's always another. They're always, who else you got? There's that.
So interesting. You know, I wonder why they would think that. Because in my mind, it's like you are a casting director. You know who's out there, who you've got. And for the most part.
But there isn't that respect or that regard.
People, really?
Yeah. They just, you know, that's part of why the job itself doesn't satisfy me creatively, is that there's some people who will collaborate with me, but everybody knows because the stuff's online and everybody can see it, then suddenly everybody's weighing in. People have opinions. You know, the assistant to the director or the intern who's working at the with the casting executive at the studio, or the marketing people at the studio for the movie, everybody's got an opinion, because there are two things that everybody has an opinion on: music and actors. Mm-hmm. And so when it used to be that they didn't have access to it, there had to be
now
more trust.
Now that's a click of a button.
And so all of a sudden they're like on a pilot, for example, there are 25 people weighing in. And so you just keep churning out the volume until somebody says yes.
How does anybody make it through anymore? Just by, like,
in my opinion,
by
doing the kind of work that it takes to be seen and to be just to rise to the top. It just, you know, at the end of the day, yes, somebody could be absolutely gorgeous, and so you need somebody who's 19 and gorgeous and funny and of diversity, and so suddenly, you know, that weeds out a whole bunch of people, because if you're, you know, over 30 and white, you have much less advantage.
Yeah,
which is kind of crazy.
Which is funny. I actually have said that a few times, that people are like, "What are you talking about?" And I'm like, I don't get cast at all for small parts anymore because they want diversity. Like if it's a like Fresh Off the Boat or Blackish show, then they want me because the main cast is already diverse.
Right.
But the flip side I've noticed is happening, where on shows that are all white, they generally will color their world with diversity,
which is great, which is an amazing thing that we're finally doing and paying attention to reality, to the world we live in. But it does mean that you know your average white guy or woman is going to have more to compete with, which is fine, understandable,
right?
But I guess my point of it all is that the landscape has just gotten larger because the demand has been for more and more and more people. And so, because we need a full-time person just to process our online
submissions and stuff,
not the submissions, but loading, you know, shooting, downloading to the, you know, uploading, editing, you know, putting it out there. So suddenly, to create a link It's the same amount of time that it used to take to do that VHS.
The VHS thing. Interesting. It's all come full circle.
Yeah, it's just the same
amount. We've gone so far, but yet not really.
Yeah, really.
So I want to talk to you. I also read that you are finding right now a passion for writing.
Uh-huh.
Tell me more about that.
The writing I'm doing is more prose writing. It's blog writing and book writing and story, you know. But I've written a few scripts. I'm not an amazing writer. I'm a great storyteller from a directorial or producerial place, and I really understand that about myself, and I love that. There are better writers in terms of crafting a screenplay or a play, and maybe because I came up in the theater and I was lucky enough to be there working with writers who, like John Shanley and Richard Greenberg and Chris Durang, who were my peers, and then having mentors in our theater company like Horton Foote and David Mamet and Shel Silverstein, who we got to write, and Herb Gardner. And
does Mamet know how to write for women, or is that a myth? Is he the one that everybody used to say he can't write for women?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have an opinion on that, to be honest. I think he writes a certain way, and a lot of his stuff is very masculine. But I really couldn't. I think it's the kind of stories he's interested in telling are from a male perspective. Mm. And having really struggled through the storytelling from a male perspective with Oliver Stone over many, many years and many movies, I understand that that's what is in someone's heart, that's what in their gut, that's what they write, then let them write that and not worry. You know, it's like I used to really push Oliver to write better stuff for women, but you know, that he was writing what he was writing, and the stories he wanted to tell were very masculine stories. More women have to write women's stories, and from a woman's perspective in order for that to change. Same thing with, you know, black writers, Latina writers, Asian writers.
I love that you say that too, because I just mentioned Bad Moms earlier when we were talking.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of blowback in the beginning when that was first announced that movie was happening, because it was written by two men who wrote the Hangover movies and all of that stuff about motherhood. And people were like, wait a minute, you can't write about motherhood. But they wrote about it from a male perspective.
Right.
So my thing was, it's like, well, it doesn't necessarily make their stories invalid, it just makes it from their perspective.
Right.
But I get torn, because then I'm so like, no, we should absolutely have a woman writing these movies, and
then women have to write their own movies, and they should write their Bad Moms version. And it's not, it's always an issue in terms of hiring writers. You know, if you have two hired women, if they're available, but if someone comes and pitches you a movie or writes the movie, you can't write this movie because you're a man, and it's not your perspective. It's your perspective. It's just, it's making decisions about what's getting made, if there's good work written and created by women versus men. And it's just, women have to get out there and do more. It's a trickier thing with, I think, directors, because there's this perception that men are better directors in film and television.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about
that. And that's not true at all, but it's what we've gotten used to. We've gotten used to having a paternal figure on set.
At the helm.
And then there have been a lot of women, and I won't name any names, who I've certainly worked with as directors, who have not been great decision makers, or who have not been great leaders.
Kind of give it a bad name.
And wherever that comes from, whatever that looks like or whatever that means, it has come around to bite us in the ass.
Yeah.
And so women, again, have to step up and
bite even harder.
Well, I think show up and do the work, not in a male way, but in a way where we understand how to show and honor leadership, you know, and have a crew and a cast respond to that. And it's just different from what people know, and people don't want it. They don't want that, you know. So it's the responsibility of women to show up differently, and it's the responsibility of everyone to make a path open for that.
And do you want to continue to direct more?
Yeah, I love being a director. You know, I've been doing
that. Do you have a preference for film and film or television in terms of directing?
Versus theater, or just film versus television?
Would you prefer film or television to direct?
No, I don't. I mean, I directed in film more than I have. I directed a couple features, so I'm more used to that. But I've spent more time working in television.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Television, all of it actually seems like it would take up a lot of time, and that would pull you away from the studio, even if you were on set for 3 or 4 months or
a
couple of weeks at a time.
I've learned over time that you do what makes you happy right where you're at. And right now, running the studio, doing a little casting, has made me really happy creatively, and producerially, I'm in a good place because running the studio feels like running a theater company
in a way,
and I direct in class all the time. It's very familiar to me. The way I approach my teaching is as a director. And so, and in one of my classes that I'm doing, we are writing and producing stuff that we're shooting, so it feels, again, directorial. And I like that. It's like I'm having another one of those moments where I stood at the back of the auditorium in high school and going, wow, this is new and interesting. I never thought I would love this, but I love this the same way I love that. Yeah. It feels like a similar kind of satisfaction and inspiration, and it's new. I never thought at this stage in my life or career that I would find something new that would keep me going.
That would inspire you that way. Talk about some of the people, or tell me who are some of the people along the way that have inspired you. You mentioned Oliver Stone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he was an inspiration or not, but you mentioned
Oliver,
mentors.
Oliver was a mentor, a certain kind of mentor. Mm-hmm. What I loved about working with him was watching him dive so deeply into a particular world and arena, and also have such a clear point of view, you know, no matter what the world was saying to him. And I thought that was incredibly brave, and that shaped that for me. Have a point of view. Be really clear on what it is that you want to say. Say it with all your heart and mind, and you know, dive into that reality so that you immerse you and everyone around you in that, and then create something that's meaningful to you and hopefully other people. So that was what I got out of that experience with him. Also, he was incredibly respectful of me as my own department head. And
oh,
so
that's nice.
Me and Billy, when we were doing it, or other people who worked with us, Heidi, Mary. And so...
Was that unusual for casting?
Yeah, I still think it is.
Because I feel like, I was going to say, I feel like a lot of times casting directors and the ones I've spoken to as well don't have that respect and don't get that collaborative...
That autonomy, yeah. And that's why people did work with him more than one time, is when you found your groove with him, he fought with you and he was... could be provocative, but he was respectful of the work that we did and heard us and heard our opinions, and I liked that. Also, there was all these different areas that were empty in certain ways the producing was happening, and so I filled some of those in. I mean, he always had really strong producers, but the scope of these movies was so huge that it required additional things. I think also my instinct is to step into that, and I think if I ever, people say, well, if you had to do it again, what would you do differently? I would be a film producer.
Really?
Or TV producer. I would do that if I did it
again.
That's
so interesting.
I would do that as opposed to just wearing the casting hat, because I think I'm an amazing producer and I see the world, the industry as a producer, and even when I'm casting, I do it with a producer's mindset. So
Do you feel like you're trying to guess what the producers will want when you're casting, or do you just sort of go, here's what
No, it's a process. Like, you collaborate. You always want to know what the writer or creator has written, what the vision is of the director you're working with, if it's a filmmaker or if it's, you know, in television, the show creator. And you try to get a sense of what it is they're looking for, and then you go, okay, you ask until you know in your gut, I get it now. Let me go figure out what that is and bring that back.
Really powerful stuff there, you guys. Didn't I tell you? Yes, I did. You can all feel free now to say, Heather, you were right. This is fascinating and very enlightening information. All right, so we're going to get back to the interview with Risa in just a moment. But I want to take another second to tell you guys about Up4 Probiotics. If you have not tried Up4 yet, or if you've just sort of been curious about trying a probiotic, what is it all about, what can it do for me, try Up4. Go to motherhoodinhollywood.com, click on the Up4 probiotics image. That'll take you right to Up4, where you can read all about their various types of probiotics. They have trademarked their super strain, which they have researched since 1979. I don't know about you, but I like to use things, especially if it's something I'm giving and putting in my body or giving to my child, my family. I want something that has research behind it. And I don't know about you, but I trust science rather than just internet rumors, right? Exactly. So go to motherhoodinhollywood.com, click on the Up 4 probiotics image. That'll take you to Up 4. You can also find these probiotics in your local Target store. Yeah, you guys, swing by the supplement section, grab a couple bottles of Up 4 that you think might be right for you. The kids cubes, they have women's formula, a senior formula, ages 50 and up. Go to motherhoodinhollywood.com, click on the Up 4 image, and that will take you to Up 4, where you can figure out what type of probiotic is right for you and start trying it. Find out now how you can start creating a healthier inside.
I had a few mentors over the years, but they were interestingly mostly men and mostly sort of father figures in my life and in my career. And I'm
like,
not
who else besides
sure Alderson. Why that was, but I'm only saying that because I wish that I had had a woman mm-hmm. as a mentor. I didn't. Maybe it goes back to the fact that I had a really strong mother and she was my mentor most of my life, and my father was not as strong a figure in my leadership and life, and I was looking for that, also looking for approval from him because he wasn't very approving, blah blah blah. Kurt Dempster, who was the Ensemble Studio Theater artistic director, who's since died, was a big figure in my growing up in the theater. But both he and Oliver had similar, I had similar relationships with both of them, in that there was antagonism, there was challenge, mm-hmm. There was needing a daddy for me. So I think that that's an interesting, it was an interesting thing. And I worked for some very strong women, but it was not a mentorship at all. And I really wish that I'd had that. I had moments of mentorships with women, mm-hmm. but very, very, very short, very brief.
Are you now finding that you're becoming a mentor to women and finding a way to become that, which you didn't have?
At times I have. Certainly in casting I have.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of casting directors out there who for whom I've been a mentor. And some actors, yeah. So yeah, that way I just wanted to close off that topic.
Sure.
Dan said that. Interesting. But because I think it's important that women support each other and mentor each other. And it's not as easy as people think. Oh, there are more women working now and they'll all make room for more women. But I've seen certainly women of the generation before me did not.
No.
Talk about glass ceiling, man. They were holding that ceiling down pretty hard because they'd had to do what they had to get to where they...
You think they didn't want anybody else eking in and taking their spot?
Because no, I'll tell you, I don't think it was conscious.
From an acting perspective, there's not a lot of other actors who mentor each other.
Uh-huh.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's not like there's an actor that's got, a couple levels up than me, is working regularly, that's like, Heather Brooker, I'm going to show you how I did this and mm-hmm. come with me, let me on my journey.
I think people would if there was some kind of arena where that could happen.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's weird. Like, I would never feel comfortable walking up to someone who's like a series regular, and or like even if I met them at a party and they're working in film regularly, I don't even know how some kind of conversation like that would even happen, because everybody seems so focused on what can you do for me, what can you give me, that I think we all kind of have our guard up a little bit.
But I think there's a lot of generosity of spirit out there. I really do. I just think that people are very single-minded in their own journey, and also isolated in that. There isn't maybe SAG. You should propose it to the SAG Foundation or SAG after to have...
I think Women in Film has a mentorship, but I don't think it's just
Women in Film
actors.
Does. Yeah, it doesn't. It's not. I've mentored people through that. But they're...
But I don't think SAG has anything like that.
But also, weirdly enough, like, Women in Film hasn't reached out to me in a really long time. I did mentor somebody for a little while, and then she kind of disappeared, and I chased her, and I don't know what happened to her, and then they never called again. But I think I was also very active in Women in Film at the time.
Yeah.
And there's so many. It's a big organization.
It's huge.
And it requires a lot of volunteers and a lot of different programs. And but I think mentorship's a hugely important thing. And the reason why I've done it in casting is because I brought people up through the work, and when you're in the midst of the work and you're bringing up people through that, then you tend to have that.
Now, you and Steve write a lot for Backstage
sometimes.
I love your articles on
Thank
there
you.
And I know a lot of my actor friends get a lot out of those articles as well, and you always talk about do the work. That's a definite recurring theme for you guys. What do in what do you think is something like a mom, a stay-at-home mom, or somebody who maybe doesn't have access to video equipment or camera, like, mm-hmm. what kind of work can they do in terms of, like, just staying creative? Do you have any
Yeah. Well, first of all, they can write. There's plenty of time to write, and if you need to take a writing class, even, I'm sure, no matter how many kids you have, at one point you can figure out a way to get out of the house and get to a writing class or a writing workshop. But I think writing is a major part of what we need to all do in our own time, and it can take the form of writing a play, writing a monologue, writing a blog, writing a book, writing a story, you know, writing a screenplay. There's so many things one can do to write, and I think the more you do it, the more you learn it, and then you get better at it. And that's the same for any writer who ever wrote, no matter how many you know, awards you've won, or Pulitzers or Academy mm-hmm. Awards. You know, you just do it, and that's something you can do at home, no matter what. Additionally, I think you can create a community of fellow artists, get a bunch of moms with kids, and do some work together, create something together. It's amazing what you could do. For example, a bunch of moms could get together with their kids, have this, you know, mom kid play date thing going on, or drop the kids off at school and then do it, and then come up with a story that you want to tell, so that Bad Moms is now coming out of those women and not a bunch of guys who are professional writers who have had some success, who now want to have a perspective on moms and women.
Because moms are hot right now. There's a lot happening with moms. There's a TV show. There's Mom, the TV show.
Right.
There's also a movie about with Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn that's coming out that's about the mom relationship.
Yeah.
There's a few TV shows in the works as well.
Yeah.
It seems to be very hot right now. The moms. Hot moms.
Hot moms. Moms are hot. Moms are hot. But imagine doing that and then coming, you know. It's like we do this in class. We just pitch some ideas to each other, and then we write some stuff. And it requires giving yourself the space and time to do that. But that's something that could happen, and people could collaborate on every week. People could bring in a scene, and you could write the movie. And people go, I don't know how to write a movie. Well, learn. You can learn online. There's
overwhelming. That's one of the reasons why I hesitate in writing any features. I've written some scripted stuff for television. Features to me seem so daunting. Like, it seems like it takes people years to write.
It can, but so what? You have years. Start now.
Sometimes it takes me hours to write an email because I get interrupted every 5 seconds.
No, and I get that, but, you know, then take the time you have.
Yeah.
You know, so many things take 5 years to write. Some things take a weekend to write. Depends on what it is.
Yeah.
And why not start, instead of saying, well, it's going to take 5 years to write, and so therefore it's too big, it's too overwhelming, I can't do it. Start now, and then in 5 years you'll have something. You may have it sooner. You know, we could workshop it. You could read it out loud. You could have a dinner party and read it. You could make a scene from it. You can use your iPhone. You don't have to, you know, have equipment. You can do anything.
I love that. I'm glad that you're saying that, because it reminds me that I do need to just start. Getting started sometimes is the hardest part.
Yeah, I know.
Can we talk about you being a mom?
Sure.
A casting director?
Yeah, yeah.
What was that like for you? Did you always want to be a mom? Or,
yes,
I did. When you made the decision to begin your motherhood journey, how was it with work? Were you able to easily incorporate it into the sort of somewhat freelance lifestyle mm-hmm. that is, you know, film and television? Or was it more of a challenge than you expected?
Always a challenge. But the challenging thing really came in trying to get pregnant and have kids, because I went through 7 years of fertility work.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it was intensely challenging. So that was so much more challenging than having kids. By the time my kids came, and they're 10 years apart, 10, I'm sorry, 10 months apart.
Oh, I was like, 10 years? God bless you.
10 months apart, which was challenging in and of itself. But by the time that happened, I was so my husband and I were so
ready
that nothing was going to get in our way. And doing the fertility stuff was challenging. You know, I remember during the earthquake in 94, our house was shook up pretty badly, and we went to a friend's for dinner. Our house hadn't been condemned, but it was on the bubble as to whether or not it would be. And we had no water, and we couldn't, no electricity, and we couldn't stay there. But so we went to a friend's house for dinner that night. In the midst of all this, I was casting a huge movie at the time. Again, before the internet was 90. I mean, there was internet in 94, but not, you know, it's 22 years ago, not like it is now.
Right.
And I was he was having to shoot me up with fertility shots. So I was like, wacky, wacky.
Stress, you know, and hormones.
Hormone down, yeah. And I'm doing this. And we had a, you know, a husky dog. And we're like, it didn't, it just seemed like we were putting one foot in front of the other. Because what we, all we wanted to do is, you know, get our work done. We both had a ton of work to do. My husband has no longer, but was in the movie business. And just, you know, get these fertility shots done and try to make a family. So that when that was such a huge part of our trajectory, it was inevitable that we would, you know, get to a point where we were parents. For us, it was inevitable because we were going to do it come hell or high water, however we did. But I mean, that was the hardest part, was trying to balance all that. And then I remember from there, then I did we did some in vitro, and I was pregnant. And I went with Paul Verhoeven all over Europe on this movie called Crusades, or The Crusade, which was not made because it was too expensive at $200 million, which now would not be that expensive for a movie that size.
But back then,
the time it was, with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was a great, great script. And again, because before the internet, before you could hire a casting person in another city and have them just put people on tape and then send it to you in 5 minutes, we went with our big heavy-duty VHS cameras to Europe, and went all over from London to Paris to Madrid to Rome. We did hire someone in Israel. And then back to Paris and back to London, putting people on tape. I'm standing in the middle of Paris. The earthquake had just happened. I left anyway. My husband was saying there was like this huge aftershock. I was shooting myself. I had been shooting myself up. I had just done in vitro, so I'd found out that I was pregnant, and then go to, you know, Europe, but, you know, doing this huge movie while desperately trying to deal with the fact that I was now pregnant. Turned out that it was ectopic.
Oh, wow.
That I had to rush to the hospital and have my fallopian tube
while you were in
taken
Europe?
Out. No, when I, just as soon as I got back.
Oh, my goodness.
Because they couldn't see the heartbeat. So I went through a lot. So by the time I became a parent, our daughter is biological but was carried by a surrogate.
Mm-hmm.
And our son is adopted. And they both happened around the same time, which is why they're 10 months apart. And so a very good friend of mine said to me, do you want to be pregnant or do you want to be a parent after all these years of this? We made really good embryos, and we had lots of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still early stages of in vitro, but I said, I want to be a parent. So she said, well, then you have to figure out how to do that and stop worrying about being pregnant.
Yeah.
And so we did some surrogacy stuff, and the surrogacy worked with Gracie's surrogate, and as soon as we found out, we met her and Sam's birth mother the same weekend, at the beginning of June in 1996. And so my kids are 19 and 20 now. And so we went into this, my whole point of this is we went into this whole procedure that by the time that we knew we were having children and having them very quickly, it seemed easier.
Yeah.
Then
like
balancing,
that was the easy part. Yeah.
Then
you got to the gravy part after having to be through everything else.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then listen, it's always a balancing act. It's always a juggling act. I have been always lucky to have a husband who has been a very present father and has co-parented with me incredibly actively. And so we did this together. We've also had amazing nannies over the years.
Mm-hmm.
People were still incredibly close to. And we were able to afford that because we were both working, and that was a big part of our lives. I mean, I took my kids to New York to do 200 cigarettes, and they were under 1 and under 2 years old.
Oh, my gosh, while you were directing that film? Oh, wow.
But I had an army. I mean, talk about it takes a village.
Yeah.
My mother was alive at the time, so she came and spent time with us. My mother-in-law was in Brooklyn, and she came up and spent time with us. We brought a nanny with us from LA, who and her husband to be our nanny housekeeper, because she was someone who'd been working with us for a very long time. And so among them, and then we had somebody locally who was sort of an intern person,
right.
And all of them were there with me and the kids, and my husband went back and forth.
But that's so great that you got to have them both there with you during that experience.
Yeah, it was amazing. And they were on set, and they were very tiny. I mean, Gracie turned one the week after we finished shooting.
Oh, wow.
And then we came back and edited in LA, so I wasn't there. I was there January, February, March, April. And they were there, and I was working nights a lot. I remember I'd come home at 6 in the morning and to my kids waking up and spend time with them, and then I'd sleep all day and then see them before I went to set that night, and it was fine. I mean, it was hard but the thing is, I believe this so deeply, that family, and I know you understand this, that family is so much the heart of your life and the touchstone and the grounding in this business, and it's really what keeps me going all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I work so hard, and to me, I'm probably a workaholic if I had to be diagnosed, but I do it because of them, for them, and from them, and that's everything. You know, if it weren't for them, none of this would matter.
Did that sort of set off kind of like the rest of your working life, in terms of you would incorporate them into jobs that you had or bring them to the office, and like how much of a part of your work did they become?
You know, for me, it was just, I think because I wore different hats, and it was easy for me to move from one thing to the other. So I'm directing a play at night, and then in the morning I get up and go to the office and cast something. And then on my lunch break, I go and have a production meeting for the play I'm doing, and then go back to the office and cast, and it's right across the street from the theater company. And then I go direct at night. I mean, I burned out doing that. But I would move from one to the other, the way I do here at the studio. If I go from the casting room.
So you've always been very, very busy. Lady.
Yeah. Yeah, and always move fluidly from one thing to the other. So then the kids was just, and the family was just another part of that. It was all working together. For me, it was like, you know, the kibbutz of my life, you know. And the thing with the kids is that, you know, I mean, they had their own lives, and I kept that, you know, it was very important to me that I would always make time for that. If, you know, I was very, very involved in their elementary school life and ran the parents council, parent teacher council.
PTA.
Yeah, I don't know what it was called at our school. It was called the council.
Were they interested in theater? Did they show any interest in that? Or
Gracie
do they now?
Did. Yeah, my daughter did. My son is a techno guy, and he's a
IT
game
kind
design
of. Oh, cool.
Kind of computer guy, lives in the virtual world most of the time. But my daughter is, I think probably because she grew up in this business, you know, being on set. When I was shooting in Toronto, that was a tough time to leave them, because I went to shoot a movie in Toronto when they were younger, I think fifth, sixth grade.
So they probably remember that.
Yeah, they do remember that.
Very well.
And they would, Gracie would come back and forth and spend time with me in Toronto, and was on set and was being a part of that. She loved it. It was the thing that, like, she probably had her moment like I did in high school directing the play, being on set and realizing, oh my God, this is where I want to be.
So what does she do now?
She's in college. Both my kids are in college. She's at Wesleyan. Sam's at a small school in Vermont called Landmark. Mm-hmm. And she's a writer and a producer, director, and an actor. And she knows that, you know, she's
a little bit of everything.
Yeah, because I know that it, from both Renee and myself, my husband and myself, it's like there's no acting only here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to do a little bit of everything. Yeah. I totally agree with
and
you.
And she's, you know, she doesn't know, she's interning this summer in L.A., and it's funny because she's really struggling with the idea of working in an office. She doesn't understand, and I get that. How could you be an artist
when
you're working in an office reading scripts and doing coverage? What does that have to do with making anything?
Well, I mean, it's kind of like you pay your dues a little bit, but I understand that too. I would much rather be out and about as well, but I think it's important to learn those aspects of the industry, because there is somebody whose job it is to just read your scripts and find the inconsistencies and, you know, the things the lawyers are going
to
freak out
over. But it's also, when you're 19 years old, to be idealistic and to think, I want to be on my feet creating work.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what she should be doing. There will always be some office ready to hire her.
Right.
But she's been working in, and also she's been interning in the Masters of Sex writer's office, which has been really fantastic. And she's writing a play that she'd written in school last year that she's evolving into a longer play, and she's here in class at the studio. She's doing a lot. Very ambitious girl.
Is she in your class?
No, she's in Steve's class.
Would that be weird?
No, she was in my class when she was younger.
Yeah.
Steve and I had a teen class when she was 15.
And how was she as a student? Would she be like, Mom?
No, not at all. No, she was very committed to her acting. And
oh, I love
she's
that.
She's talented, which is fun to see, you know.
Have you cast her anything? Will you cast her in something someday?
I don't know.
Maybe?
I don't know. I'm not thinking about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's been an interesting balance. And I think what my kids have seen is a mother who is hardworking and has, you know, balanced it. And you can't, obviously you can do it all. Not at the same time.
Right.
You know, but you do one thing and then you do something else and then you do something else. But I think just my nature being... Mm-hmm. Again, producerial, it's like I'm always producing a version of my life, a piece of my life, whatever that is.
What is your feeling on moms or dads, parents, who have to bring their kids to an audition? Like if somebody has to come in, because I've had to bring my daughter in with me to an audition.
I think it's fine
before.
As long as it doesn't interfere with your work. I mean, I've mm-hmm. seen it work really well where kids show up, and other times when it's very distracting and the parent, man or woman, mm-hmm. mother or father, mm-hmm. can't focus because they're worried about their kid or their kid can't sit still or
yeah.
you know it's I think it's only a problem when a parent shows up and dumps it in the office and says can you dumps the situation
yeah
you know and says can you deal with my kid because I got to go in and read, and that can be a little challenging for the staff.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, I'm very much about bringing your kids to work.
I have a lot of mom friends who are actors
yeah.
and writers, and they're all kind of trying to figure it out. How can we balance these two worlds that
yeah.
we love so much? And that's what Motherhood in Hollywood is about, is my way to try to figure out and learn as much as I can
yeah.
About what I want to do and where I want to be in life, while also still incorporating my daughter into it somehow. And I've had to take her on auditions before, and she's...
How old is she?
She's 3 now.
Yeah.
She's been going on auditions with me since she was 2 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And... at times it's been distracting, but she's pretty used to it now.
Yeah.
Like she just
yeah.
will hang out and be like, and she likes to sit and watch. And
as long as it doesn't interfere with your work.
No, I mean, it's stressful in that you've got your daughter there with you
right.
and you want to, you know, tend to them always. Like it's
right.
sort of an instinctual thing. But it's much better now for sure. And I'll never forget one time we were leaving the audition room and she had been sitting there watching me. And as we're walking out, she goes, "Good job, Mommy." And I literally went, and I was just like, it was just the sweetest thing.
That's funny.
Because I was like, oh my God, you get it. You know that Mommy, I'm going to
yeah.
cry right now thinking about it. But I'm like, you get it. You know what Mommy's trying to do. And it's so nice to talk to other moms who
yeah.
have been there and they've gone through it and have worked their motherhood
yeah.
into their career.
I mean, it helps to have a partner. It helps to be able to have help. But I think it's really troublesome when you think that you have to give one thing up for the other, and you don't try at least.
Right.
And then you find your balance. And sometimes when I say from one to the other, it might be from one to the other in the day, course of a day, or it might be one thing to the other in the course of a year. You know,
mm-hmm.
there are times when I certainly wasn't working as much and I spent more time in my kids' school life, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But, you don't sleep a lot, but then you learn that at an early parent,
right?
Young parent.
Not many parents are sleeping.
And I don't
much.
Think I've ever slept since. But I think there's value. I think that the one thing that pulls parents away from kids more even than a job is, you know, being on the internet and.
Oh,
you know, so you're sitting there, you know, but you go to dinner and everybody's on their phone, or, you know, you're at home and you're on Facebook instead of being with your kids, and your kids are off,
mm-hmm.
you know, watching a movie on Netflix, and your other kid's off on the internet surfing
yeah.
the internet. And then everybody in a family gets completely splintered
isolated.
And isolated, you know, because of technology.
But it's
that's
hard
become
because
a real problem.
It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where you have to, there's especially in this industry, as a parent, you feel like you have to have an online presence all the time,
right.
be tweeting something funny, posting whatever you just ate on Instagram. You know, you have to constantly be going,
yeah.
hey, I'm generating something.
But again, it has to be about something important. It has to be about
mm-hmm.
something that you've created that you love. It's not just about, you know, having... having a presence where you're just trying to have a show up and be clever.
And that's the key. That's the difference.
You know, that's the difference. If you're doing, I'd rather see somebody take a year, incubate, create something, quietly write something, shoot like even 5 minutes, and then when you put it out there, you put out something that you're proud of, that you love, that's of value, and that's rich content, and that's, you know, shows talent and integrity and vision and a point of view, and then it matters, because then it's going to have some consequence to it, rather than just a daily tweet that is just clever.
Right.
I mean, I believe in having a social media presence and having a point of view, but then it's got to be about something, and you've got to, not for its own sake, it's got to, because you have something to say, it's because you have something that you, and then you, and then you've, if you are going to do that regularly, because you're going to want to put stuff out, you, then you have to, as you know, with what you're doing, then you've got to just balance it and realize, I'll do this on Sunday and this on Monday, and carve out time. It's all about scheduling. At the end of the day, it's all about how you schedule your time, and then also find time for self-care, you know, and self-nurturing, so that you're awake and alert and present, and you feel good about yourself, so then you can be such for your family.
Mm-hmm. Tell me quickly a little bit about the studio, how you and Steve came to be for the BGB studio. It's such a great place. It's such a wonderful home for actors, and I think I read that's how you guys designed it to be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, we knew each other just in the business, and he had auditioned for me. I've cast him, and he had a website that I found really intriguing, and he revealed himself later that he was the man behind the door, and he wrote some very provocative things, and he always said nice things about me, but he was very provocative, and I loved that. And so we started meeting for coffee, and then our coffees turned into longer meetings, and then we said we should do something together, and let's do a class, and it just all happened very naturally and organically, and boom, we were off and running. And that was 4 summers ago, where we did one class with teens.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked, and then we decided, let's do a class for adults, and then we created and he was also teaching on his own, and I was teaching on my own, so we came together and did that in October of 2012, and that was the beginning of the studio with 2 classes, and then we grew and grew and grew.
For some reason, I was thinking it had been around a lot longer than that.
No. I mean, we've been around a lot longer individually in our careers and our lives, but no, the studio's not even 4 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I guess January of 2013 was our sort of official beginning.
Opening kind of thing.
Yeah, we never had an official start, but that was when it was the beginning of that year. We came into this space and we launched a few more classes, and it all happened the way things all should, organically and naturally, and evolved into this. And you know, we're just still trying to figure it out. We have so many ideas and so many plans, and you know, so many things.
Is it hard to kind of rein it in and figure out what to do first? Is that what you're kind of doing now?
Yeah. Trying to, you know, also have lives and be with our families.
And
Steve's got a 2-year-old daughter, and we're taking some time off at the end of the summer, both of us. He's going to go away for a couple of weeks, and I'm going to bring my kids back to college for their sophomore year.
Wow.
It's hard to believe. take a little time in New York. So it's really finding that balance, which is always a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to call it a struggle, but it's always a challenge. You always have to just be able to say, this is me time, this is creative time, this is work time, this is family time, this is time with husband, this is, you know, alone time, in both self-care and in creating. And when you can really designate that for yourself, I think it's a lot easier. But it does require stopping and looking inside and just evaluating where you're at and what's important to you and what you care about, and then honoring that.
Yeah. Do you think there ever comes a time when an actor says or should say or have enough recognition that maybe this isn't the path for me?
Sure. All the time. I think you have to evaluate all the time.
Because I think there's a lot of actors, and I know there's a lot of friends of mine who have been doing this for 15, 20 years, have never booked a show, have never broken through in any way at any point, and still work part-time jobs, you know, trying to make ends meet and that sort of thing. And not that those are necessarily, like, the points to check off. Well, I better wrap it up, you know, but, like, at what point do we go, man, I may never make it as an actor. I should really focus my efforts somewhere
else. Well, I think there's a reframing of that phrase, make it as an actor, because mm-hmm. you can be an actor and be, and not maybe even make a dime. You could be creating work, you can be doing theater, you can, it's just what you call making it as an actor. Because the whole line of, I'm going to get a co-star, then I'm going to get a guest star, then I'm going to be recurring, then I'm going to be a series regular, then I'm going to be a, that's like, that doesn't, you know, that there's no reality to that, really. I don't think there's truth to that. I don't think there's, you cannot evaluate who you are by letting the industry define you in that path or that journey. What you have to do is figure out who you are as an artist and as an actor and how you're going to realize that, whether someone hires you or not. And if you give up on the dream of, you know, getting to the red carpet through that particular path, then yeah, you probably have to give that up at some point and go back to, why do I love this? What's my why? What is it about this that is going to keep me happy and creatively satisfied? And then how do I do that? And then let the industry find me or not. But that's what has to be important. Come to your core values of why you're doing this to begin with and how to satisfy that. And when you do that, first of all, the rest of it becomes unimportant. Second of all, the industry tends to find you when you're really honoring that in yourself as a creative being.
I'm just going to clip out everything you just said and just replay it over and over to myself in my car every day. Okay. Isn't that weird?
No, not at all. I mean,
I do need to hear that. And I think a lot of my actor friends really, and who are listeners, like, they need to hear that.
Yeah. It's important that we have to rethink this, rejig this notion of success.
Where can everybody find you if they want to?
I'm right here all the time.
Find you. Just come up at the corner
of Vineland and Riverside. And I just found out from my son that our, if you look at the window there, you can see that our billboard is a Pokemon fighting gym or something.
Oh, how funny.
Yeah. So this is where we are, at the Pokemon fighting gym at the corner of Vineland and Riverside, and online at BraymanGarciaBraun.com, which is hard to spell, but if you just Google the BGB studio, we're right there. We've got a great website, lots of blogs and podcasts and audios and videos for people to
I almost forgot to ask. You just cast Gilmore Girls.
Yeah, with Jamie.
How was that?
Fun, yeah. I mean, Jamie had done it for 7 years, it's really her baby. And
I need to go in there and give her another hug and be like, Jamie, if Gilmore Girls ever comes back. No.
Well, I think it's
they only did four
90-minute movies. That's winter, weird. Spring, summer, and fall.
That's unusual,
like,
right?
The song. Well, it was an unusual thing. I mean, they never, the creators of it, Amy and Dan, never even thought about this until it was suddenly in the ether. And
fans were just dying.
And it's great. It's a really good.
It hasn't been released yet, right?
November 25th, November. I think. I don't want to say that's the exact day, but I think that's the day. So it's right the Thanksgiving weekend, which is a great time. Everybody can cozy up.
It's perfect.
You know,
some Gilmore Girls time of year.
And then keep going through Christmas and watch those four 90-minute movies, you know, binge watch. 360 minutes of it. It's a lot. They talk fast. It's all.
Oh, yes.
It just picks up where it left off in a way. I mean, it's 10 years later, however many years later, but it definitely is more of the same in the best way possible.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
I think I'm excited for that. We were big fans of Gilmore Girls for sure. So I think it's going to be very well received.
Cool.
And so everybody, I'm going to also put Risa's information on. I always want to say your name, Risa. And it's not, I know that's terrible, but it's because I'm a Star Trek nerd.
Oh, yeah.
And
Right.
Do you watch Star Trek at all?
No, but Steve does and my son does.
Yeah, there's like a planet called Risa. Anyway, my nerd is showing.
I'm not a planet, I'm just a person.
There you go. Yeah. Thank you so much for
taking the time to be
on my show and answer all my questions. So, you guys, I'm going to put Risa's information up on motherhoodinhollywood.com so you guys can find out where to follow her there as well. And remember, I'm not a perfect mom, but I can play one on TV. Bye.
Mama funny.
Balls.